I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. It's time for the monthly politics segment. Lots to cover. There's the space shuttle, Florida Senate race, SunRail, Rick Scott, growth management in Orlando or lack thereof, and the connection between former state GOP chief Jim Greer and Casey Anthony. 90.7's political commentators Dick Batchelor and Lou Fry are here to weigh in on all this and more. That's coming up next on Intersection. And I'm joined by 90.7 political commentators Democrat Dick Batchelor and Lou Fry, Republican. Batchelor, of course, a former Democratic State House representative, and Lou Fry, former Republican congressman. Guys, great to have you both in.
Thank you. Great to be back.
I think.
I'll take questions three, and four.
Yeah, thanks. I'll take nine.
A, B, C, and D. So Space Shuttle Atlantis launched last Friday, concluding NASA's 30-year shuttle program. And I wonder, especially from you, Lou Fry, because I know you've been keeping track on China and developing nations around the world. Where do you see this void being filled now that the shuttle program is coming to an end? Is a country like China going to step in and make a bold statement now that the U.S. is going to be basically out of the human spaceflight game?
Yes. Okay, more. It's China announced today that it was starting its space station that would be done in 2020. The United States announced that it's closing down its space station in 2020. We are out of the space program. We really are doing very little. It's a national disgrace. It started with Bush, who didn't push the Constellation program. Obama didn't do any help. We've destroyed a sea of knowledge of the people in the space program. There's no way you can replace it. I handled it from day one on the floor of the House, Dick, and I was over there for the last one, and it really was bittersweet. And to see it go up, thank God it is, and that's going to come back. But, yeah. It's really, really, really important. When we've got to rely for our space station and the Russian and Chinese, it's a little nervous. And, Dick, space is supposed to be pure and no military stuff or something. But just think, if the Chinese or the Russians, who'll be in orbit and doing all these things, have a laser that could take out all our GPS, they'd blind the country. This is a real trauma that people don't understand.
Dick Bouncer, do you share those kind of fears?
I do. And in fact, I was at the Apollo Soyuz flight, and that was 1975. And if you think about it, the space industry, if I might call it, that was so young then, but then it wasn't that many years ago. And it's going to have has already had a very substantial economic impact on our community here. And I think while defense is not supposed to be a part of space, you know, we can play by the rules, but that doesn't mean everybody else does. And I think you have to anticipate that people are going to break the rules. So I think we should be in space. I think there's some opportunities there. And I think this presidential election will probably put space back on the front burner. Because I don't know how you can come back.
Time, Dick. The problem is like, if you want to start a new program, you're looking 5 to 10 years away. And do we have 5 or 10 years?
But the other side of that coin, though, I guess, is that people who don't live in Houston or don't live in Alabama, don't live in this area of Florida go, well, space programs, it's kind of sexy. It's out there, but it kind of might be old hat.
Bringing rocks back from the moon.
We're spending a heck of a lot of money. Is it really worth it? So it was a big debate in Congress, obviously, and we're not winning that debate right now.
We haven't won it. That was the toughest bill for me to handle in all the years to get through. Is I had to handle that every year, and we barely got it through. And you had to fight the fact that one of the Fry rules, you got to explain you're in trouble. We were talking about the spinoffs of the space program, the 7-to-1 economic return that we had, the fact that we wouldn't have the computer industry if we hadn't had it, the Earth resource satellites, the communication satellites. I can go on and on about this stuff. We never were able to sell it. NASA did a bad job. The Congress did a bad job. People never understood the impact of the space program, the good it did. There was more technology that came out of the space program than anything but a war, and that sure ain't the way you want to get your technology.
Amen.
What do you think, Lou Fry, about the proposals to build spaceports at the Kennedy Space Center? I saw a special on CNN the other night that showed that the spaceport out in New Mexico is just about built, the physical building. Right now, Kennedy Space Center doesn't have anything like that.
Well, Kennedy Space Center is going to have to make up its mind that it wants to compete in the free enterprise system and in a non-governmental area. And that's what the big hope is that we can attract rockets and that from all over the world and use this as a launch center. And that's good, and that's a good idea. But that still doesn't go to the heart of the problem, which we need a national space program, and we don't have a national space program. And it's going to be we're not going to get a national space program that way.
Well, which way should we do it, Dick Batchelor?
Well, I think it's still interesting, too, and Lou pointed out and you alluded to, is that the fact the privatization of space, the commercialization of space, certainly has some potential, and there are companies willing to spend some substantial money. Now, whether it meets what Lou would like to have, I can't get fall short of that. But I think we're going to talk later about the budget cuts. We're going to talk about the budget cuts and taxes, those kind of things. If you look at that whole debt problem that we have, you can't take space off the table, and it's going to be seen as kind of a project that rewards certain states, not unlike defense.
And it's an easy one to take off the table because there aren't that many people defending it. But, again, you have to get past the initial look and look at what the space program has done. And the real question is, do we want to turn over space? Do we want to return technology to India, to Pakistan, to China, to Russia? My answer is heck no.
U.S. Senator Bill Nelson flew on the space shuttle as a payload specialist in 1986 when he was a congressman. Nelson, of course, has pushed hard to extend the shuttle program to preserve jobs on the Space Coast. And I wonder, Lou Fry, where does the end of the shuttle program leave Nelson in this race for re-election? Is this going to be a weapon used against him now that the shuttle program's going away?
Well, probably it will be. I don't think it's fair. I think he's one of the few people who really has worked awful hard on the space program and that. The problem is that he believed the president and about some things that were going to get done, and they didn't happen.
What things are you talking about? The $40 million in helping retrain space workers?
Well, that was one of the areas, but also Bill Nelson felt that we were going to revitalize the space program, and that's what Obama had told him. And you can only do so much as whether you're a House member or a Senate member in it, and I think he's really legitimately tried. Now, you know, it's the same old story. If you're in office and things are going well, you get credit you don't deserve. And if you're in office and things are going bad, you probably get a bang out of it. And I think it's probably going to be something that the Republicans will use as part of the overall job issue, which I think is much more important to Nelson's reelection than this.
What's going to make him the most vulnerable in this race, if not the space job situation?
Well, I think what makes any Democrat this time vulnerable is the fact that the economy is bad. And in a state like Florida, where there are more Democrats registered than Republican, if things are really going well, a Democrat under normal circumstances should win it. In Florida, normal circumstances are probably an oxymoron.
Absolutely.
But he is there. There aren't many Democrats rerunning for office, and Florida is a swing state. So I think it just makes political sense to put him up on the board as someone that you're going to probably run after.
Dick Batchelor, if you're Bill Nelson, how do you spin the loss of the shuttle program and all those jobs out there?
I give it the best fight ever. I mean, he was not only very much in favor of it, he actually was a congressman originally from that district. He was an astronaut himself. He took the lead on negotiating with the White House on the funding. But I agree with Lou. The fact is, if you're unemployed, you know, that's the first question. If you don't have a job, that's the first question. And whoever's responsible for it, keep in mind, our mentality in this country is, what have you done for me recently?
Like
very,
yesterday.
Very recently, like today and maybe tomorrow. So, you know, so they can turn that into an economic situation, obviously losing jobs, cutting industry, high-tech industry, that kind of thing. So, yeah, they can use it against him. But I think he's in the strongest position on that.
Well, you're talking about job placement. One person who's hoping that they will get placed into a job is Craig Miller, who is entering the race on the Republican side against Bill Nelson for that Senate seat. He's the former chief executive officer over at Ruth Chris Steakhouse, and he finished third in the 2010 congressional race for then-Representative Suzanne Cosman's seat. Sandy Adams did take the seat in the end. Is he going to be a big player, or is he just being tacked onto this list of folks that include Mike Haradopoulos and others that are all vying to challenge Bill Nelson?
Let them eat steak. I can hear the campaign slogan now. It's not a bad deal. Look, you've got to be a big player. I mean, you got the Senate president has raised several $1 million. Now, it begs the question of whether or not he could have raised that money if he weren't Senate president. I think the answer is no, but he has raised the money. Hastert's coming in about $800,000. That's not enough money. When you talk about running for the United States Senate, you're talking about several billions of dollars to be able to run. Look how much money was spent in the governor's race. One candidate spent $78 million. So unless he can generate a tremendous amount of money and a groundswell, he's just just
Dick, what race are we talking about?
The U.S. Senate race.
That's this year?
Coming
up. Very few people know about it.
Well,
very few people know about
it. I guess.
In fact, the fewer that know about it, Bill Nelson likes to begin with.
Yeah.
So, and here's another thing, too. Senator Haradopoulos, Senate presidents and speakers of the House, when they serve, they always think people know who they are. Well, they don't. In fact, if you look at the popularity of the Florida legislature, it's lower than the governor.
And the Tallahassee bubble.
And the governor's at like 30%. But the state legislature's popularity is below that. So to run for Senate president, probably I would not run, raise the money, but not tell anybody I was Senate president.
Because once you're out as Senate president, the new guy's coming in, you can forget a lot of the money. But
I say that kidding
about the Senate race because it's really overshadowed by the presidential race, which is getting started this early, and really nobody's caught on that much, and it's going to be a money issue because nobody's going to know you. It's a name recognition thing. If you can raise the money at the end and get your name out there, that you've got a chance to steal the nomination for the Senate, and I think other people still may get in the
I agree too.
In the race.
More hopefuls?
Yeah.
Who do you think is going to get in that hasn't declared
yet? Well, Dick
yet?
Has been talking to me about it, and I've been urging him to
talk to me about it.
I'm prepared to speak for or against him, whichever will help him. I'm over the sidelines just waiting right now. The strongest candidate, I think, did not get in the race, which some signal of something, and that was Connie Mack. Congressman Connie Mack, the son of the former United States Senator Connie Mack, did not get in the race, and I think that's quite telling. Other than Haradopoulos, you don't have any very strong candidates running.
Cliff Stern has been talking about it for some time. He may be there long enough that he just wants to roll the dice and either get in or out. I just think there may be some businessman sitting there, a Jack Eckert reincarnated or somebody like that, who may want to jump into it. I don't think the field is set.
I think it's interesting that the names that you mentioned, Lou Frey, are experienced political hands. Do you think, is it an age factor? Do you need someone who's of a similar lengthy background political-wise to challenge Nelson? Or is there a young
you
person,
do. I
a
think
Rubio?
You can get somebody with a bunch of money back in it. It could be a tough race. But don't write Bill Nelson off. He's working hard. He's campaigning hard. He's been a decent, honest person, and which are all pluses. And I think that's going to be a really tough race. Again, I go back. If there's any coattails in Obama, I think Nelson would be the favorite. On the other hand, if Obama doesn't have coattails but has whatever you don't want, I think Nelson. I'm sure you'd come up with something, Dick. Nelson is probably in trouble.
Well, you'd have somebody. One of the cabinet members might have been a stronger candidate, either Jeff Atwood or Pam Bondi or Adam Putnam, for Secretary of Agriculture, former congressman, very sharp cookie, Republican, of course. But one of those people stepped up and could raise some money. To me, they would bypass Haradopoulos. I agree with Lou. I think somebody's going to get in this race. When you've got a vacant, it's not a vacant U.S. Senate race, but on the Republican side it is, somebody's going to step
in. That's a once-in-a-lifetime shot if your timing is right. I mean, you can't let that go by.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. We're talking with political commentators Democrat Dick Batchelor and Republican Lou Frey. I'm Mark Simpson. Tell us what you're thinking about Florida politics right now on the WMFE Facebook or Twitter pages, or you can send email to intersection@WMFE.org. You talked about that Tallahassee bubble just a moment ago, Dick Batchelor, and Governor Rick Scott has been shaking up his leadership team in Tallahassee. His chief of staff, Mike Prendergast, now is going to be heading the Florida Department of Veterans Affairs. Mary Ann Carter, another top Scott advisor, has announced her resignation. Is this a usual time to see a shakeup about 6 months into a governor's term, or is something going on we don't know about?
About the time you drop below 30% in popularity is about a good time to look at your staff.
Yeah. Even 32%.
Yeah, right, even if it's 32% margin of error. But obviously, he has not done very well at all. The governor doesn't have any support. In fact, what will be interesting to see if which candidate for U.S. Senate asks the governor to endorse him, if none do, because he doesn't have the popularity right now, and he's got to change. He brought in no experience, and not to be critical of his agenda, but I would be on many points. But just to have somebody there, you need to have somebody there as the chief of staff, has institutional knowledge, knows the players, can get around Tallahassee. Made a big mistake. He doesn't understand public policy, and he's really offended a lot of the leaders in the Republican-led House and Senate. So he had to change staff, and he really needs to sit down with the House and Senate leadership and basically say, we've got a session coming up. It starts in January. We have reapportionment in the budget, legislation. What can we do? What can we agree on now?
Together.
And to be able to drop the handkerchief in the session saying kumbaya.
Are you saying it's him that's offending folks, or the staff, or both?
No, I think it's him because his staff doesn't know how to deal with people. He had staff that had no institutional knowledge, did not know the players, did not know the issues, and then running down to the House and Senate basically trying to leverage the governor's office or using the leverage of the governor's office to get the House and Senate to do things they didn't understand. So I think if he brings people on staff, he's got a little bit of time on his, under his belt. If he starts listening to the House and Senate leadership and agree on what they can pass, I think his numbers will improve. But
all lost, though, Dick. I mean, he got off to a rocky start, and I think he's learned one thing. You can't run the government like a business. Now, you can use business principles in that, but it's not a business. I mean, it isn't a business. You got to deal, as Dick said, with the House, the Senate, you got the Supreme Court, and you've got to actually go talk to people about what you're doing, and so they don't read it in the paper. I mean, there's nothing worse for a member of the House or Senate to have a major project going and read about the fact the governor's candidate in the paper. Nobody's even told you.
High-speed rail is what you're talking about.
Yeah, I'm talking about
vetoing the appropriations the Senate President and Speaker of the House have put in the budget. They vetoed all the PICO funding, public education capital outlay, impacted UCF by $32 million. Those are projects that were, I think, legitimate, were in the budget legitimately. The Speaker of the House, Dean Cannon, from here, put them in the budget along with a delegation. The governor vetoes those. Well, you can't veto $32 million and not have some repercussions.
Yeah, you got to tell them you're doing it. You got to sit down with them and explain with them. Because one thing in politics, the person that's against you today, you always have a chance to get them with you tomorrow.
Absolutely.
And don't burn your bridges. And boy,
unless you can walk on water.
Yeah. And he's burned a lot of bridges, but I think he can actually come back.
Well, Lou Fry, you mentioned he could come back. He has burned bridges. Just recently, Governor Scott attended a policy retreat last month. He tried to keep it on the down low with powerful conservative donors Charles and David Koch. The billionaire Koch brothers, of course, very influential on the national scene and helped kind of spur the Tea Party movement. What do you make of Rick Scott's attendance there? Does that mean that some people are hopeful Rick Scott's going to be a player on a bigger stage?
Yeah, Rick Scott's staff certainly thinks, and I think Scott underneath thinks that anybody that's the governor of a major state like this, New York, Texas, Florida, and that is looking nationally. It just makes sense. I mean, you got a great stepping stone. You got a bunch of electoral votes to start, and you're in a key state. So obviously you're looking down the line. You're not going to be content with being just the governor. And that's a disease. It doesn't affect just Democrats or Republicans. It affects both of them. And so a lot of the stuff you've looked at, and I think one of the reasons that you're seeing a change in this kind of thing is I think that Scott not only was not popular in Florida, but he was getting to be a joke in a lot of places around the country. And that certainly isn't the image you want. Hey, look, who's going to be vice president? You get a Romney from Massachusetts. You need somebody who's conservative from the East Coast who gets along with the Tea Party. I mean, he's got some credentials nationally in terms of being a viable candidate for vice president.
That's what you're saying on the national scene. A little closer to home, Governor Rick Scott did approve SunRail a couple of weeks back here. The Central Florida commuter train now expected to be up and running early 2014. How does or how did SunRail change things for Rick Scott, whose poll numbers are so low? Does this mean he had to cave to Central Florida political pressure at all?
I think he had and I don't think cave's the right word. I think he deferred to maybe better judgment. You know, Congressman John Micah, for instance, chairman of the House Transportation Committee, a very strong Republican. In fact, he served in the State House with John. And this is his legacy. He's worked on it for many, many years now. And it will produce jobs. And it will do something about, hopefully, our congestion. So it's a major project. But everybody was behind it. Jacob Stewart for the Chamber of Commerce. I mean, the Republican business community. Everyone was behind it. So I think what he probably did, he probably said, look, you know, maybe I should take a deep breath and look at the Republican establishment for a change, not just at the Tea Party. Now, I think part of what his strategy was is have the Secretary of DOT go around and hold these hearings in Dayton and Orlando and all, and basically to see if any of the Tea Party activists came out. Well, there were six people turn up. Six, and I still define the Tea Party as a movement without a head. And I think that's anecdotal of what his problem is. He really needs to go back and see that his base is the Republican Party, and it's not the Tea Party. You don't need to cave in and go to the villages for everything that you do. You can accommodate the agenda of the Tea Party, but do not rot off the Republican Party and fully embrace the Tea Party. You need to go back, and your base really is the Republican Party.
But he did. I will give him credit in this one. This is one of the first times he actually talked to people and obviously listened and took into fact not just some philosophical thought, but some practical thought. And the fact that a lot of the people here and that his constituents likes it is a lot different than the high-speed rail. I mean, this had to go through. And by the way, you're right. John Micah really, really deserves a pat on the back. He has worked so hard and so long on this, and he deserves all the credit in the world for it.
You know, I want to talk a little more local, too. We've seen recent projections from the University of Florida that show Orlando, the Orange County area, are going to lead the state in terms of growth during the next 30 years. Of course, we had big changes to growth management laws during the last legislative session, and Orange County commissioners last year voted against two mega developments on the east side of Orange County, Innovation Way East, Ryebold Park. Now those sound like they're going to come back up again for consideration. What do you think it's going to mean, given that this study's just recently come out, that the growth is projected to continue and that these developments could be back on the table?
Well, first of all, what they did, the Growth Management Act, was but very bad. And, you know, it passed in 1985. Florida's been a model state and really a bellwether state when it comes to growth management, trying to look at developments of regional impact or how they should be accommodated, in particular when it comes to infrastructure. In other words, you can't build a community unless you have the infrastructure in place, the sewage, the water, the lighting, and schools, very, very important. Now, with this Growth Management Act gone, everything is shifted back to the local level, and you don't have the influence of the Department of Community Affairs looking at this. So I think there'll be more and more pressure put on local officials. Obviously, it's easier to get four votes out of seven commissioners than it is to try to get, you know, the legislature, the cabinet, or the Department of Community Affairs to vote for it. So I think we're setting a bad precedent here. And notwithstanding the growth, you could only have the growth that you could accommodate. And the question is, do you want to impact your freshwater supply? Do you want to impact the school system? Or do you want accommodations to be made? So only if those infrastructure needs can be met should you accommodate growth.
And the other thing we need is jobs. We can't get that growth and have the county run like we want on just tourism. It just isn't going to work. And we've been a failure as a community, my part, all of us, to attract the high-tech jobs. I was able to keep the technology center and the simulation industry here some years ago and that, but that it's grown some. But we don't really have other things. I mean, hopefully what's happening south of town with the hospital and the VA and all that will be a nice center in that. But we've got to be able to show, I think, to the community, our leaders do, that, yeah, this growth is going to come, but we're going to have jobs to meet it. We're going to have high-tech jobs to meet it, and we've really got to do a crash course, if you will, in bringing industry into this area.
And you got to give credit to the mayor. I mean, Mayor Jacobs, the county mayor, has obviously been having hearings about jobs creation and in very different sectors. And one of the goals should always be, not unlike former Mayor Rich Crotty, and that is you're trying to attract jobs that pay above the medium scale. Every time you open a hotel, it creates jobs. But the fact is, most of those jobs are low-income jobs. The technology sector, the medical sector, the medical technology, that's where the jobs have got to be created. And you can precipitate growth, but it has to be jobs created, I think, as Lou says.
What do you think, though, about the fact that now Orange County leaders are considering layoffs to have to help balance the local budget here for Orange County? $3.2 billion budget. Workers in the county's group foster care program are looking to perhaps bear the brunt of potential cuts. Orange County Mayor Teresa Jacobs says it's unrealistic to find a position for everybody. Is there a better way to balance the budget? And how do you balance that out with the growth that's anticipated to happen, right? You get more growth, more development, more money comes into local coffers. Shouldn't you be able to support those vital services?
Well, on one hand, you should, but the fact is they have a $3.2 billion budget, and they have very minimal layoffs as far as their layoff of number. About 500 jobs have been laid off in Orange County in a year and a half. But that's through attrition. They didn't hire anybody to fill those positions, number one. Number two, there might be a net loss of 30 or 40 jobs with a county this big, that many thousands of employees. That is a very minimal impact. And I also have to give credit to Teresa Jacobs again, because she saw that the health care cost to the employees is very, very high. So she's come back in and taken the savings from the state, where they're required now to pay under the pension fund, to use that to subsidize the health care coverage, because it went from a 90-10 to an 80-20 and very high deductible. So she's looking at taking care of those employees. And I hope the budget is not cut in the area of Great Oaks Village and foster children, those services. Those are badly needed services, particularly in this economy. So if you're going to cut the budget, it doesn't have to be that much money. So maybe across the board they can find a place to cut. But I hope it's done in the area of children's services.
We've had studies in the state in the past that, for instance, show that basically people who come in and live on their Social Security are a net loss to the state. In terms, this is pure economic question. I'm not saying right or wrong, but I mean it's the economic numbers. And I think you're going to find too that the there's going to be a push and pull between numbers and between quality. And I don't think we can afford just to concentrate on the numbers. I don't think we should be disappointed or excited when we look at the thing. We ought to be a little bit forewarned about it. But, boy, if we don't do anything without any legislation to guide us and so forth, this could be a community that's a lot different than most of us have grown up in.
Well, one thing that had a lot of attention in Orange County over the past couple of weeks is the Casey Anthony murder trial. Of course, she was acquitted. She was acquitted of first-degree murder, and that, of course, has inspired an internet campaign for laws requiring caregivers to promptly report missing or dead children. Florida lawmakers calling it Kaylee's Law. What do you think, guys? Is this going to pass?
Well, first of all, as a non-lawyer, and I just want to make clear that just because she was acquitted doesn't mean she's innocent. But I think it will pass. It'll probably be state by state. There's some federal legislation, too, but I think this is one of those things you do at the state level, and it will pass as soon as
I hope it would pass, too. I don't think in this case it would have made, unfortunately, any difference in terms of what happened to that poor little girl. This will
be like the Adam Walsh era when John Walsh's son was found missing. Had no Adam Walsh legislation. In fact, the late Senator Paula Hawkins filed the legislation, created the Center for Missing and Exploited Children. So you're going to see a lot come out of it. So fortunes and good things will happen.
All right, Dick Batchelor, Lou Fry. Here is the Casey Anthony Jim Greer connection. Chaney Mason. He's attorney for both. He's defending the Florida GOP chairman, Jim Greer, who's been charged with fraud and grand theft. So does the Casey Anthony acquittal bode well for Jim Greer?
I don't think it bodes well for either defense attorney, to be very candid. And I know this is personal, but I watched it pretty darn closely, particularly the closing arguments. And the fact is that the facts didn't win out in this case. The lies did. And so I don't know if it does anything for Mr. Baez or Mr. Chaney Mason. Chaney is a very, very smart lawyer, very smart lawyer. And I wish him well. But on this case, I don't think
I think the facts are, you know, from what little I know, but the facts are different. We still don't know in the Casey Anthony thing. We, you know, all of us have ideas. But what she died from, it's hard to have a first-degree murder case if you don't know what cause of death.
But if you're Jim Greer, are you happy that your attorney just got this big victory?
I hope I'd be happy in the sense that maybe he doesn't want as much money from me.
So yeah, I started to say he'd be happy if Chaney Mason could say pro bono.
Yeah.
All right. Democrat Dick Batchelor is a former state House representative. Lou Fry is former Republican congressman. Now with Lounge Drostic, Doster, Cantor, and Reed. Dick Batchelor, of course, with the Dick Batchelor Management Group. Guys, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online on the Florida Talks blog. Visit WMFE.org/intersection to find out more. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. What's your favorite space shuttle memory or political space shuttle memory? Feel free to share it with us on Facebook or Twitter. You can visit also Facebook to see photos from the Kennedy Space Center behind the scenes visiting the Vehicle Assembly Building, Shuttle Atlantis on the pad before that final liftoff. Send email to intersection@WMFE.org. Support for the program comes from our listeners and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Amy Green is the assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.